Coming up next, Upstate's HealthLink on Air. On this week's program, we address the issues of obesity and nutrition in school-age children.
There are clearly environmental factors, contextual factors of your school and your neighborhood. And then there are family factors, some of which may be genetic, might just be social and cultural. And there are all sorts of possible explanations.
Plus, new cholesterol screening guidelines for children.
The problem that I think is probably the bigger problem is just related to overweight and obesity.
And nutrition concerns for older adults.
Some of the nutrients that are fundamental and essential are less able to be absorbed as we age.
We'll have all that and hear a piece from our healing muse, and that's all coming up right after the news. This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On this week's show, we take an in-depth look at nutrition, with the rising risk of high cholesterol in kids, plus the challenge of maintaining good nutrition as we age. But first, the growing epidemic of obesity in school-aged children. Childhood obesity is a national epidemic. Nearly one in three children ages 2 to 19 in the United States is overweight or obese, putting them at risk for serious health problems. But what are the contributing factors to this new and growing problem in the U.S., and what can be done about it? Joining us with some insight into all of this is Dr. Amy Ellen Schwartz. She's the Daniel Patrick Moynihan Chair in Public Affairs at the Maxwell School of Syracuse University. Welcome, Dr. Schwartz. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
So this is a big problem in the United States, and I think it's even in some places, not just the United States, it's happening on a large scale throughout the world. What do we mean when we talk about childhood obesity? What does that actually mean?
Well, it turns out that defining obesity is perhaps a little bit less straightforward than it might seem, but mostly what we think of when we think of obesity is some measures that are based on a child's body mass index. And if it's over, say, the 95th percentile, we might think of that kid as obese. And if it's slightly lower, we'll think of them as overweight. And that's kind of based against national norms. But there are other ways of measuring it, and some folks think about that in terms of measures of body fat.
But how and why has it become such a significant problem? I mean, it seems like it's growing quite significantly.
I think the evidence is that it grew quite substantially and alarmingly for quite some period of time. And I think now it's kind of leveling off, maybe. That's not to say it's going away, but the big upturn has we've turned the corner on that. Although I don't think we've seen a decline yet. Question is why? That's a little harder to answer. And I think folks like me are looking for the answers of both why and what we can do about it.
But it seems like there are both potentially genetic issues that play a role, but then the bigger concern is behavioral issues, obviously, because you have some control over, or you don't have control necessarily about what's available in terms of food, but you do have some control over what you choose to eat.
Absolutely. There are clearly environmental factors, contextual factors of your school and your neighborhood and your block. And then there are family factors, and there are individual factors, some of which may be genetic, might just be social and cultural. And there are all sorts of possible explanations, that range from, the food desert folks were used to worry about. I'm a little less worried about that, I think, than maybe
that.
Others. The idea that you really can't get good food in a neighborhood. And so maybe that's why.
Well, some neighborhoods, I think that probably is true, that there's lack of access.
It is
especially
true.
Especially to fresh and healthy food.
But what's really important thing is, if we're looking for a population-based intervention, which, to be honest, is what I'm interested in, then we have to look at things that are big enough to affect everybody or many people. So in the work that I do, I'm interested in what's the school lunch environment like? What is kids' breakfast like? In new work we're doing now, trying to understand what is the availability or proximity to fast food and fresh vegetables and good food. So I'm interested in these environmental features. We don't know that much about it.
Well, one of the things that's come out in recent years is this whole notion of how much is being sold in our standard groceries, you know, food chains that is not really food. In other words, that is, you know, 15 yeah. different chemicals before you get to any nutritive value. And this whole notion of pushing the idea of eating more whole food or food that our grandmothers or our great-grandmothers...
eat food, mostly plants.
Exactly. Right? Yeah.
Not too much.
That's right. Exactly.
You know, that seems to me as sensible diet advice. And certainly it's what I tell my own children, I tell myself. But, you know, in the work that I'm doing... I'm really interested in how we set the stage for that. Mm-hmm. You know, what are we doing from the public sector point of view that makes eating well easier or
harder?
Or harder, exactly.
Well, some of it's education. Some of it, as I said, is what's happening in terms of the food production industry in this country. I mean, the classic situation of walking down a cereal aisle and you have all these bright and shiny boxes of nothing but corn.
Absolutely.
Or, you know, Michael Pollan, as you quoted so well, or nothing of any nutritional value. And so we're eating these highly calorie dense foods with a lot of sugar or high fructose corn syrup. And we're perhaps not even realizing that we're not getting the bang for our buck nutritionally.
Undoubtedly. You know, there's all sorts of issues. Another one would be, you know, soda and sugary beverages, which we know just have huge amounts of calories and are really easy to drink. And so this, I think, is a particular issue for kids.
What's interesting to me, though, over again, all of that was available when I was growing up, and I'm in my 60s. So all of that was available then, and we didn't have this kind of this upturn in childhood obesity. Today, there seems to be more of that. And the question I have in my mind is, and I think many people think, is why now? Why so much now? Why more now? And one thing that strikes me is also what happens to kids that's different than when I was in that age range, is that kids are more restricted very often in terms of being physically active. I mean, I'm wondering if you found that in some of your observations research.
I should confess it's not something we've done a whole lot of work on yet.
Right.
You know, I share that concern, and coming from an education research background, and I did a bunch of other work on schools, you know, you get particularly worried that the role of physical education has changed in the schools, pushed in part by people with good hearts who were thinking, we really have to make sure kids get the academics that they need. And there was a big to-do and big discussion about whether that pushed out the focus on physical education and pushed out that. Is that true? Is that a big cause? I don't know. Have we made it harder for kids to walk to school? I mean, when I was a kid, I walked to school and played outside after school, and that was...
Exactly. We rode our bikes, we walked long distances, and there wasn't so much the concern for childhood safety, I think, as has emerged.
Yeah. Maybe misplaced lack of
potentially
concern. But, you know, is that the big cause? I don't know. I don't think we know these things. It was actually kind of surprising to me how little we know about this issue. And, you know, as I said, I've come from doing education research where we have many years of doing very good work looking at what causes kids' test scores to go up or down. And part of the reason for that is there's a huge amount of detailed data on that. And I'm not saying we know everything we need to know about that, and there's a lot more work to be done. But there's no similarly, well, there hasn't been similarly good data on childhood obesity, childhood weight. So when you think of these big population-based studies in education and about children's academic success, they're just not matched with work on obesity.
Well, it's yet to be done.
And it's the work that we're doing, the work we've been doing in New York City on childhood obesity is possible only because New York City started doing the fitness gram for every kid every year.
I'm gonna have you hold that thought for a minute. Okay. I want to get back to that, but let's talk a little bit about what the consequences of obesity are. I think we've alluded to them, that there are health consequences. I mean, what do we know in terms of if kids are obese as youth? What ends up happening?
Well, I think the there are two kinds of issues. You know, there are the immediate issues, and you know, clearly there are immediate issues. Kids are at, you know, higher risk of certain kinds of illnesses, and you know, they at an extreme, they can have sort of secondary and related health conditions. But I think that perhaps a bigger concern, and for more people, is that childhood obesity will lead to adult obesity, which we know was associated with a whole host of medical issues.
Cancer, heart cardiovascular. Disease,
exactly.
High blood pressure.
Diabetes, right. You know.
The whole laundry list.
Right, exactly. And those are a big problem.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen, along with Professor Dr. Amy Ellen Schwartz, and we're talking about childhood obesity in school-aged children and potentially what can be done about it. So we know that if you are an obese child, you more than likely will go on to be an obese adult. And we have plenty of data to show that obesity leads to all these kind of health concerns. But I think even in the obese youth, they are more likely, even at that stage of life, to have high cholesterol or high blood pressure, and they sometimes will develop a pre-diabetic condition. So it's not that they only have to wait till mm-hmm. they become an adult. Mm-hmm. It has real consequences then. So what can communities and or schools do to make a difference? And that's been the heart of your research. Tell us about that.
So surprisingly, I think we have lots of good ideas and very little that's been shown to be effective. And so my research and my energy for this research comes from trying to figure out what has worked and what do we know that a community or a school can do. The most exciting is the research that we've just completed looking at what I think of as just an incredible intervention. It's putting water jets into school cafeterias. And in that, what you're doing is making available drinking water to kids at lunchtime.
Now, how is that different than basically water fountains that existed in schools, or do they no longer exist?
Great question. You know, when you think about a water fountain, you think about, you know, one kid at a time and a long line, and they turn the thing and a little thing goes up in the air. It's slow. It may or may not be cold. And a handful of kids can get through that. What the water jets do is they deliver the water quickly, and it's chilled. So a kid can go up and just quickly get a cup of water, and the next kid, and the next kid, and the next kid. So it's really increasing availability.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. You might have seen something like this in your office building, where you can go to fill up your jug of water. The idea is you're not standing there for a whole 3 minutes waiting for the water that might be lukewarm. You're in, you got your cold water, and you're out.
So what did you find?
So we find childhood obesity goes down in the schools that adopted the water jets.
And this was just in the cafeterias, placed just in the cafeterias?
Just in the cafeterias. So, you know, one or two, a handful of these in the cafeteria, no requirements, no rules. We didn't actually, this wasn't implemented as part of the study. This was implemented by the Office of School Food in New York City. They started rolling these out. They're inexpensive, to see what would happen.
So you found a correlation between the installation of these and a decrease in the amount of obesity in that population.
Absolutely. I would go a little bit farther. I mean, what we find is that after the installation of the water jets, obesity goes down, weight goes down. And we're convinced that this is a causal effect, because we're able to compare it to other schools that didn't get the water jets, or to schools that haven't yet got the water jets. So, you know, this isn't a huge effect, but it's significant. And I think it's the kind of intervention we should be looking for. You know, we're not going to solve childhood obesity with one big intervention. I think it's going to be like lots of other things. It's lots of little interventions.
So tell me about the whole idea of how changing the kinds of food that's available in schools. I know, granted, schools are the kind of capturing place for
kids.
That's
right.
I mean, and my own, in an earlier life, I was very involved in schools as a school board member, and I understand that the schools are often looked to as a place to really solve all of society's ills because we have a captive audience.
That's right.
And so in this case, we're using the school as a place to represent the community in a way. It doesn't take care of all the outside hours that a kid is not in school. But let's just get back to this. So if you offer within the schools an improved nutritional resource, how have you seen that make a difference? In other words, you've looked at certain programming. What have you seen?
Well, we haven't looked yet at what happens outside of school, we're hoping to do that, looking in a study that maybe I'll come back again and tell you about next year.
Great.
But I think there's a couple of different ways these things can interact. First of all, what's really important about school lunch is that, we're not adding something new to what schools are doing. Schools are doing this. This is one of the largest federal programs for providing food to people. I mean, right after SNAP. So this is a huge program. We're already doing this. Question is, what does it look like? Who gets it? What do we charge? So we're not creating a new burden. But we're trying to fine-tune something.
But fine-tune it in what way to affect obesity?
So here are some things. Water jets, salad bars, changing the availability of competitive foods, say reducing the availability of soda in vending machines. These are all things that can both affect what you eat at lunch and what you learn about eating outside. So the fresh fruits and vegetables programs and salad bars, they might not affect your obesity this week or next week, but over the long term will change kids' exposure to food and what they think about when they eat. So we're hoping to do research on these, and we're starting that.
Now, in the very little bit of time we have left, you did do some work, though, actual research on this idea of the breakfast.
Absolutely.
Briefly tell us about that.
We looked at what happened when New York City went to free breakfast and kids started to eat more breakfast, and we looked at breakfast in the classroom, and we found no deleterious effect on obesity, and in fact, a little bit of evidence that it might decrease it. So it could be that, after all, school breakfast really is the most important meal. But, I've always more work to be done.
Well, it's very exciting work. It's very important work. I thank you so much for coming in and beginning to share it with us. And I would welcome you to return again when you have more information or more studies to share with us. It's obviously something we need to do to make a dent in this, even if it's a stabilizing problem in this country. But thank you so very much. I appreciate your coming in. My guest has been Dr. Amy Ellen Schwartz. She's the Daniel Patrick Moynihan Chair in Public Affairs at the Maxwell School of Syracuse University. Coming up next, the rising risk of high cholesterol levels in kids. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen joining you. According to new data from the Centers for Disease Control, 1 in 5 children and adolescents in the United States had at least one abnormal cholesterol measure. And a greater proportion of adolescents ages 16 to 19 had high cholesterol levels compared with children ages 6 to 19. Well, here to help us understand what all this means to our children's health is Dr. Travis Hobart. He's assistant professor in the departments of pediatrics as well as public health and preventive medicine at Upstate Medical University. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming in, Dr. Hobart.
It's my pleasure.
So recent data suggests that almost a quarter of kids in this country have high cholesterol and not the good kind of cholesterol. So tell us about that.
Right, and this is a growing concern among children. Obviously, people have talked about high cholesterol levels among adults for a long time, and now we're starting to see that this is becoming a problem amongst children as well. I think the big problem is that as children get older, they go through puberty, and their cholesterol profile changes. And that's why I think when you mentioned that it's more common in teenage children,
it's because their cholesterol profile has changed as they've gone through puberty. In addition to that, they've sort of had more time to become overweight or obese, and that certainly contributes to the problem.
So you're saying
as well.
That in addition to the fact that in some cases kids just may genetically have a tendency toward a higher cholesterol, their weight, or in this case their overweight / obesity, may also be contributing to their serum cholesterol levels.
Yes, definitely. There are certainly a lot of cholesterol problems are related to genetics, definitely. There are some factors that we don't know about. There are a small number of children who have a familial cholesterol problem where their cholesterol level is very high, and these familial diseases lead to very early heart disease and heart attacks down the line.
So you see that in running in families.
Right. But that's very rare. We rarely see that we know about. And the other problem that I think is probably the bigger problem is just related to overweight and obesity. And that affects more children, but usually their cholesterol levels aren't as high as if they had a genetic predisposition.
I'm curious as to what the motivation was. It the fact that there was a rise in a greater rise in obesity, childhood obesity, that led people to start to take a look at the cholesterol levels of children? Because this is a fairly recent phenomenon. Am I correct?
Yes. I think that it is related to the change in obesity rates over time, and also recognizing that this is such a problem in adults and that it starts in childhood. And there have been some studies in sort of a grotesque manner almost where unfortunately a child will die because of a car accident or some other reason. And the people have studied them and done autopsies and found that they have these plaques and buildups of cholesterol and fat on the inside of their blood vessels as early as teenage years. And that leads down the line to heart attacks and stroke and heart disease and peripheral vascular disease.
So the thinking here is, with so many other things, is that early intervention or early discovery, early diagnosis / intervention is always preferable. And so if we already know that these problems occur in adults or young adults on into their, you know, their full age span, that looking at younger children makes sense if you can do something about it. And we'll get to that in a minute. What other factors, if any, seem to play a role? You've already alluded to the fact that some people have a genetic predisposition, but a small percentage have that. What other factors put people more at risk?
Right. So interestingly, we do see certain racial differences as well as differences in sex. So, for instance, in terms of, well, first of all, I should say there's sort of two kinds of cholesterol. There's the so-called good cholesterol and the so-called bad cholesterol. The good cholesterol tends to help break down these plaques in the vessels that I talked about and bring them back to the liver for processing. And that's why it's good, because it helps get rid of these plaques.
And that kind is often known as what?
It's called HDL, for high-density lipoprotein.
And those are, if you have a high level of that, that's good for you.
That is good, yes. And then the bad cholesterol, or LDL, is low-density lipoprotein. That's the kind that is being transported by your body out of your liver to the other parts of the body for use. And there are reasons that your body uses cholesterol, but the downside is that it builds up on the insides of the blood vessels.
So it's like the plumbing is starting to get clogged
by
this LDL.
Yeah.
By this bad
cholesterol. And so when you have high levels of that, that's bad. And so the reason to make that distinction is some of the differences in cholesterol levels are different depending on who you are. And I think there's probably still study needed to be done as to why that is, but there are certain differences. For instance, when in terms of the percentage of children who have low good cholesterol, it's a little more common among boys than it is among girls.
So therefore, they have higher bad cholesterol, relatively.
Yeah. So not necessarily. Well, yes, I think that is true, because it's, when we talk about total, there's total cholesterol, and that's a combination of both good and bad cholesterol. Now, you can have good cholesterol that meets the sort of minimum standard and also have bad cholesterol that's above what you'd want, and vice versa. So you could have
Any combination. Any,
you could have any combination.
But the bottom line is, my question here is, though, so in younger children generally, let's just talk about the bad cholesterol because I think it's clearer for people. Mm-hmm. Are we seeing bad cholesterol in younger children, or is it more often that you're seeing these higher levels as children age, is what you've alluded to before?
Right. It's more often you see it as children age that they get sort of high bad cholesterol.
And how about, are there sex differences? In other words, you mentioned boys. So are boys more likely to get the bad cholesterol than girls?
So no, actually boys are less likely than girls to get bad cholesterol. So girls tend to, at least the data that we have from the CDC shows that girls are about 9% have high bad cholesterol, and boys more like 7.5% have high bad cholesterol. But then the situation is a little bit reversed for low good cholesterol. And whereas boys have a little bit higher rates of having low good cholesterol. It kind of gets difficult to discuss.
So bottom line, who's better off?
I don't think we can say one way or the other. You know, I think in general, both are, you know, both, it's important to pay attention to both the good cholesterol and the bad cholesterol.
Because one basically intervenes and helps the other.
Right.
The good cholesterol helps defeat the negative effects of the bad cholesterol.
Right. And it's important to take each patient individually, in a sense.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on air. I'm Linda Cohen, along with pediatrician Dr. Travis Hobart. We're talking about high cholesterol levels in U.S. kids and what to do about it. Let's get to what's come of this, though. We know that, obviously high levels of cholesterol, bad cholesterol, can lead to all kinds of problems. So what new guidelines have emerged as a result of it? I know the American Academy of Pediatrics have come through with some very specific guidelines.
Yes, they have. And in the past, the AAP, American Academy of Pediatrics, had recommended screening for cholesterol levels just based on family history. And if there was a family history of a problem, of a heart attack or high cholesterol, then we would be testing, especially if the child was overweight or obese. What they're recommending now is actually to do screening on everybody, so that every child between ages of 9 and 11 would get tested for their cholesterol level. Okay, and the reason is because family history can be somewhat of a limited history. If the parents aren't both there at the time, they may not know, one parent may not know the other's family history.
So they've broadened the recommendation basically to screen all children. Why did they start at age 9? Why not younger? Just out of curiosity.
So I think mostly because the problem is not as big in younger children, and also age 9 to 11 is to try to get it before puberty, mm-hmm. because when puberty hits, obviously it's variable. Children get it at different ages and the cholesterol levels change. So if you check one child before puberty hits and check another child after puberty hits, the levels aren't, it's going to be hard to have a normal value because.
So the bottom line is, right now the current recommendation is, just to restate it, is basically screen all children between the ages of 9 and 11.
Yes. And then again, between 18 and 21.
And what is the hope there in terms of, you know, what is the expectation and the hope in terms of.
I think with cholesterol, part of the difficulty is that we tend not to want to put children on medicine that they'd be on for the rest of their life in general, and in cholesterol specifically. And I think the idea is that if we get a sense of children's cholesterol early, we can effectively institute dietary changes, exercise, things like that, that would help the cholesterol level improve over time in the individual child. And also a sort of broader public health goal is that if we're bringing this up at every child for their 9 or 10 year old visit, it's reiterating the importance of healthy eating and exercise.
So it's kind of coming to the problem, or it's a multi-pronged way, in a way, or a way of hitting all children, so to speak, as part of their preventive care, to look at this factor as being important. An important indicator of their potential overall health.
Right.
Because it's not, there isn't a direct one-to-one correlation, is there, between a child having a higher cholesterol at the age of 9 and going on to having heart disease in adulthood?
No, there's not a one-to-one correlation, but children with higher cholesterol are much more likely to become adults with high cholesterol. if you will. So, and I think the numbers that I've seen was if they have a high cholesterol at a young age, then it's about 75% chance that they'll have bad cholesterol. I guess we should say a bad cholesterol profile at an older age.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to look at it. Mm-hmm. So let's get back to treatment, because obviously treatment is somewhat problematic even in the adult population. There have been a lot of studies that have shown that while statins, which are the first line of defense with mm-hmm. high cholesterol, are very effective in many cases, they also come with a lot of side effects and potential problems. And some people, I know I myself have had issues where I couldn't really even take a whole variety of these different iterations of statins. Mm-hmm. So, and yet we don't really know anything about how this type of drug would affect a growing child, because right. as your colleagues have told me many times, children are not simply small adults. Right. So what happens, I mean, when would you consider, under what circumstances, for example, going beyond the diet and exercise route and talking about treatment?
Right. So typically when we talk about treatment of cholesterol as well as treatment of overweight and obesity in pediatrics, we try to do it in a stage-based model. So we go to the first stage of diet and exercise, and then if we need help with a cholesterol level that's not improving after those changes, then we tend to refer to a specialist who's either an endocrinologist or a cardiologist who can really manage the cholesterol with a statin. And as you said, we don't like to use medications for long periods of time in children, and we don't know the long-term consequences of the statin use in children in a lot of cases.
So while it might be effective in lowering the cholesterol, we really don't know yet at this stage of our knowledge what the long-term effects could be of a use of a statin in a child. And maybe right. if there seems to be more of this kind of problem occurring, that maybe we'll have to develop other methodologies going forward.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for coming in and sharing all this information with us. It's very important, and I think people out there really need to know that now it's important to begin to look at cholesterol levels in kids as well as adults, and to sometimes take some measures in that direction.
Yeah,
thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Dr. Travis Hobart, Assistant Professor in the Departments of Pediatrics and Public Health and Preventive Medicine at Upstate Medical University. Next up, the challenges of maintaining good nutrition as we age. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen here with you. Getting adequate nutrition can be a challenge as you get older. As we age, the number of calories we need begins to decline, and every calorie that we consume must be packed with nutrition in order to hit the mark. Here with more on all of this are Carrie Carlton and Cecilia Sansone, both registered dietitians and certified dietitian nutritionists at Upstate Medical University. Welcome. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Linda.
Let's start with you, Carrie. What happens as we age to both our interest in and our capacity for food?
Yeah, you actually, in the beginning of the introduction, talked about some basic overall changes that happen as we age. We have a decrease in our lean muscle mass. That's also known as sarcopenia. We have an increase in body fat and a decrease in both total body water and decrease in bone mineral density. So those changes in our bodies as we age will change the amount of carbohydrates, fat, and protein that we need. So overall, we need less of all of those, less calories, specifically.
How about our interest in food, though? In other words, do things change as we get older to affect the way we look at food, care about food, or even our capacity to take it in?
Yes, throughout our lifetime, not even as we're older, but just in general as we age, our influences on food choices change. It can be influenced by culture, socioeconomic status, food available. But specifically as we age, we have a decrease in
the muscles of our mastication strength, so chewing might be more difficult. Our salivary glands decrease in number, so things might not taste as good. And that also goes along with a loss in sense of smell, and that will change the taste of food. So foods that we used to like might not be as pleasurable anymore.
Cecilia, when we're saying older adult, let's try to define this now. What ages are we talking about when these kinds of changes are actually taking place?
Generally, we're talking about people who are 65 and older.
Okay. And do we actually lose in our capacity to take it in? In other words, I know our stomachs don't literally shrink, but maybe our eagerness or interest in eating certain amounts of food, does that change too?
Well, I think depending on what's happening in somebody's life, all of that can affect people's interest in food. If a person has, for example, they live at home, maybe they lost a spouse, or maybe they are becoming a little bit more less independent, all of those things can make people just not want to eat. Or if they also have some other kind of illness to deal with, they're dealing with what are the limitations or things with that illness that might prevent them from eating too. Sometimes people might get depressed. People definitely are living longer, so they may develop more of those challenges along the way as they go.
Because now we're talking about people living into their 90s quite often.
Correct.
And even beyond. And so you would think that some of the changes that may be taking place as early as 65 and older will continue and continue.
Correct.
So a lot of the things you're describing have to do with the whole aging process in general and the environment in which they find themselves.
Right.
I mean,
right.
Some of them, as Carrie was pointing out, are clearly just physiologic changes. Mm-hmm. But what you were just mentioning, Cecilia, has more to do with lifestyle issues.
Correct.
In terms of even you, maybe if you're cooking for yourself, how well you can cook for yourself, if you never cooked before because you had a spouse cooking for you. I mean, a myriad of other factors play a role.
And some people don't even want to cook much if they now are by themselves, too. It's only me. There's no reason to cook so much.
Getting back to the physiology, though, Carrie, does our body decline in its ability to actually absorb these key nutrients? Or either of you?
Yeah, some of the nutrients that are fundamental and essential are less able to be absorbed as we age, and that includes B12, folic acid, calcium, and vitamin D. And that's all because of the changes in the body, including a decrease in gastric acid production that can help specific nutrients be absorbed. And we just want to make sure we get enough nutrition as we age, because if we become malnourished as we age and we have all these other things going on, we might have chronic diseases, risks for hospital admission. If we're malnourished, it's going to impact that outcome as well.
So let's talk about, you mentioned four things right off the bat: vitamin B12, folic acid, calcium, and vitamin D. Let's just talk about those in a general sense. What do we need to know about them? Where do you get them? What kinds of foods should people be focusing on to try to get the biggest bang for their buck? I know with vitamin D, for example, that's very illusory. You don't really get that from food, right, Cecilia? Isn't it mostly?
Well, yes, from things like dairy products are important. So they talk about people drinking enough milk, and as people age, maybe they have an intolerance for milk. But on the market now, there's so many more products that offer alternatives.
One of
the things,
fortified, so there are
fortified,
cereals and juices,
and there's like alternate milk choices. For example, soy milk. There's all kinds of other, that are becoming a lot more prevalent in this area. Everybody, young and old, usually has a problem with vitamin D because we don't get much sunshine.
Vitamin D basically helps the body absorb calcium, and it's mostly made in our skin from sunlight. Is that correct? So that if in our community here in central New York, because it's cloudy and we don't get as much adequate sun exposure, perhaps, people in general are low in vitamin D. So bottom line is, what do you recommend for people, especially older people, in terms of how they would get these things that we talked about, vitamin D, calcium, folic acid, vitamin B? Where do they go for those types of foods, Carrie?
We like to look at, as dietitians, an overall food pattern instead of specific nutrients. So focusing on nutrient-dense foods, whole grains, fruits, vegetables, healthy proteins. If someone's eating enough of those, then they will most likely get enough nutrients. If a doctor suspects that a patient or one of their patients is deficient in any of these, they can get their blood levels tested. But we want to focus on getting enough food in general to make sure we get enough of those.
Enough food quantity is what you're saying, but there's a quality issue here too. And I think you were alluding to that, Cecilia, before when you were saying partly this is an issue of eating whole foods, perhaps not packaged foods that are processed. It's a lot of the same stuff that we hear about in general for all ages. Isn't that correct?
Correct. Correct. And every nutrient has its job to do in the body. And you want to make sure that it is able to do that. And we mentioned, we didn't really mention so much protein and calories in general, but protein is used to build muscle. And if someone is not getting enough calories and good source calories, that protein can't be used to do its job. So protein can actually be used as a calorie source. And,
so
and you
meat,
don't really want that.
Fish.
You want that to be correct. Meat, fish, poultry. Again, dairy has a substantial amount of protein. And then there's nuts, seeds, and then there's protein in the whole grains that Carrie was mentioning, and many vegetables.
So. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen, along with registered dietitians Carrie Carlton and Cecilia Sansone. We're talking about the nutritional needs of the older adult. How about things like fiber and or this whole, you know, push for omega-3 fats? I mean, again, what strikes me is as you get older, perhaps your food tastes, your interests start to shrink. And so you might be eating the same things over and over again. You may not have much variety. And so what Carrie was saying earlier about if you're eating a varied diet, you'll get all these things. But I think with the older adult, you're less apt to be eating a varied diet. So what do you tell your patients, Carrie, or what do you say to families when you have concern about this?
When I talk to patients about this, I make sure to individualize the conversation to their specific needs. So we look at where they get their food, who's around to help them, and what their regular meal patterns are like.
So on that note, is it better for an older adult, for example, to be eating 5 small meals a day as opposed to the standard 3 larger meals a day? What's your feeling on that?
It can definitely help because of, like we talked about, the age-related changes, the decrease in tastes, slowing down of peristalsis. So if someone is open to snacking, that's a really good way to fit in those nutrient-dense foods.
But the snacking shouldn't be traditional snack foods, like potato chips and pretzels and popcorn kind of thing. But snacking, when you use that term, is that you're eating small meals spread throughout the day, almost like grazing, as opposed to sitting and eating a full, perhaps harder to digest, full meal.
Right, in this one we talk about nutrient-dense foods and high-quality foods. So having, if someone is okay with chewing, having a fresh apple or having some fresh fruit, or if they have an issue with not being able to chew an apple, you know, applesauce or something rather than the chips that you mentioned is a higher quality type of snack.
What do you see as the greatest challenges for individuals as they age in terms of maintaining this, well, let's say even this issue of fiber, for example, and or fluids? Because there's been some talk that there's very often a tendency for people to become dehydrated as they age. What do you say, Carrie?
I would say the biggest thing or influence on an elderly person's intake just from my experience, because there are so many influences. I see the support or the people around them being the most, one of the most important things. Being around people can help increase your intake. If someone's around it, help you and encourage you to drink fluids. If someone's around to help you feel connected and less depressed, all of those help with your intake.
How about water? How important?
Water is excellent. There are other forms of fluid that people can take as long as they're not just filled with what we hear as empty calories. Water obviously can hydrate. I think each person has to look at their own particular case. Sometimes some people need more water if they should be on a diuretic medication, because that can kind of promote somebody to be dehydrated. And again, water's an excellent nutrient.
So what's the bottom line? Just in a little bit of time we have left, what would you say the bottom line is, either of you? What do people need to remember as they age in terms of getting what they need?
Eat nutrient-dense foods and
so that's whole foods,
yes.
Fruits and vegetables, a lot of protein, stay hydrated, good amounts of fiber, and continually eat throughout the day as opposed to trying to do the three main meals?
I think so, and I think to capitalize on things such as if they are someone who likes soups, for example, adding a lot of things, vegetables, meats or chicken to that soup and make it almost like a meal in itself. If they can't eat, a big meal, it can make it the best quality type of meal.
Great, great advice. My guests have been Carrie Carlton and Cecilia Sansone. They're both registered dietitians and certified dietitian nutritionists for Upstate Medical University. Thanks so much for coming in. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now, Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Thank you, Linda. Some of our most dramatic poems come from parents whose children or grandchildren have life-threatening medical conditions. They describe for us the continuum of emotions, the endless hope, the eternal love, the fierce protection of a parent's love. Mary Jo Balestrieri is the author of several books and divides her time between Wisconsin and Florida. We have two poems from her. The first is Rainfall and a Darkening Sky. Her narrator is bringing her daughter home for the last time. Driving home from the hospital, she curls into the back seat. Our daughter will spend whatever time is left at home. Our hopes run high through fear. I stop at a farmer's market and buy bunches of black-eyed Susan, daisies, and huge orange sunflowers. She immerses her head in their petals. A sudden downpour, again. It's been raining hard and fast, and the pond has already infringed on the lawn. Will the water keep rising? How will we handle the change in our privacy? Nurses 24 hours a day? The pain? We climb the last hill toward home. What will it look like, her last climb beyond me? I see her as she was, fishing with the boys on the pond's edge, her cardinal's cap, the worn jeans she couldn't part with. The lanterns in the drive guide us into the valley. The house is dark. I switch on lights, slide her into a wheelchair, push it up the ramp. Inside the house, our voices seem loud in silence, small, in the vastness of space. The second poem is an ode. It's called Sunflower, an ode. In the house, strange to me now, jammed with nurses, medications, wheelchair and walker, I depend on your survival. Each morning I open the curtain and count on seeing your bright face. You steady me. Crowded as if in a foreign land, in a barrel of petunias, you stand tall and strong. And the way you brave weather on the fiercest days, the whipping wind, the pelting rain, you teach me all over again how to stay planted, grow in my given soil. Though words wither like wheat stalks in drought, you, fiery corona, petaled face, brown eyes, you flower before me. Your radiance staves my despair. Neighbors walk their Dalmatians. Geese scout the lawn for seeds and corn. A father and son fish in the middle of the lake. Here in the house, I wander without purpose. On the kitchen table, a drafting pencil, paper, and books of poetry. I casually write sunflower on a yellow legal pad. A breeze ruffles the word's edge, scatters seeds in the rich loam of imagination, expands. My daughter's voice calls from the bedroom. Her voice, part of the aura. I offer her grape juice and buttered toast. She asks me to open the shade. We sit together on her bed. The sun brightens our faces, and I show her my sun out the window. Let's follow the sunflower, I say. We'll lift one foot, then another, inch into the day. This is the only thing we need to remember.
Thank you for joining us for HealthLink On Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Join us again next week when we find out what's new in lung cancer screening, plus how to talk about personal health issues with family and friends, and what it means to be a pediatric anesthesiologist. If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it on iTunes. Just search for HealthLink On Air. That's all one word. And to keep up with all the goings-on at Upstate, you can look for us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter, or check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.